This is a recording with Aboriginal artist Tony Albert on the 18th of November 2013 in Lilyfield. So, Tony, can you tell me your full name and when and where you were born and who your mob is, please?
Sure. Well, my name is Tony Albert. I was born in Townsville. My family come from the rainforest of North Queensland. In Cardwell, that's where both my grandparents settled and my grandmother's country. But our family goes right up to Cooktown, Dirrell, Hopevale, around there, right down to the rainforest. So the language groups included in that area are Kukulyalanji and Gugumithithia in the north, and then Gidame and Yidinji in the more rainforest area. So that's where I'm from. I did all my schooling in Brisbane. So my father was in the army, so we did travel quite a bit. So I did school in Brisbane and now living and working in Sydney.
Excellent. So can you tell me, you went to university and studied art? Yeah, can you tell me what course you did and what
yes.
university?
Okay, so it was actually during high school I was really interested in passionate art. So I did... this special program where you do 4 days a week at school and 1 day a week at an art school. So that was a great kind of foundation in, I guess, techniques and mediums and actually learning how to paint. But from there, I went to Griffith University in a course, Bachelor of Visual Arts, majoring in Contemporary Australian Indigenous Art, which is at Griffith University at the Queensland College of Art. And it's the only university-accredited degree for art in Australia that's just for Aboriginal people. So it was set up by Jennifer Hurd. Vernon Arkey was a former student there and was a lecturer of mine. So that was a three-year undergraduate course, which I think, you know, was a great foundation, very important, I think, in my progression into art to be able to go to a college like that.
That would have set a really good foundation for you, being, you know, having people like Vernon as lecturers and...
Absolutely. I couldn't believe, you know, it was like the course was made for me. It was everything I had ever wanted to do, and these amazing people that I looked up with and inspired me were the teachers. So it was a great kind of foundation or entry point into the art world.
So you've recently been announced as the selected artist to create a public artwork which will honour Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander servicemen and women in Hyde Park. Just wondering, can you tell me a little bit about the idea for the concept for that artwork?
Sure. When the call out came out for a national memorial in recognition of Aboriginal servicemen and women, it was something that took my attention, you know, straight away. It was a theme that I've been looking at in my work previous to the tender process, and something close to my family's kind of history, and that's why I was already looking at it. My grandfather was in World War II, and there's an incredible story attached to his time there, which I drew inspiration from, but also seven of his eight children. So my father... my aunties and uncles had all served in the infantry in either the Army, Navy or Air Force. So there was this combined history within the Australian Defence Force, which I guess gave me the confidence to kind of put in. I've never done public art before. I've done large-scale artworks, but public art is something to me that, you know, one, is it incredibly significant and important, and it depends a lot on the space as well and where it is. So I'm very sensitive about those kind of issues. But this is one where I felt like, yes, I do feel like the appropriate person to be to be doing this. And my grandfather's story certainly gave me the strength to put in the application. So I had also worked with the Australian War Memorial as a war artist and worked with the Border Security and Sea Patrol in the Northern Territory. And as part of that, I did a lot of research at the War Memorial, and what became apparent was that my family story was really replicative of a lot of oral histories in our in our people, in our community. These things weren't recorded. They weren't, Aboriginal people couldn't enlist under being Aboriginal. They had to, say they were other ethnic groups. So the realization was that it was an incredibly hard thing to do to find, you know, how do you do a memorial for all these people when the reality is we might never know how many Aboriginal men have ever served or anything like that. So I decided to base it, to use my grandfather's story as this kind of metaphor or symbolic symbol, this amazing story that is replicative of all of these amazing stories. So that that was the kind of foundation of it. And this, he was actually a prisoner of war in Germany and escaped with six other men over the Italian border to a small farming village known as Biella. And a farming family, actually, they took them in and had them hiding in their farmhouse. They were captured by Italian soldiers at that point and sentenced to execution. So they were actually lined up, and three of the men were shot before an officer in charge said that they are British allies and need to be returned back to Germany. So my grandfather was one of the survivors that witnessed the three shootings, taken back to the prisoner of war camp in Germany. And interestingly enough, there was a Noongar man from WA who survived that ordeal with my grandfather. And they were taken back to Germany, and when the war had finished, were returned to the British soldiers. They were flown back to London and then caught a boat back to Australia. So there's, you know, a lot of incredible kind of things going on in that story. So I thought that that could be a really amazing opportunity to start a conversation and for the memorial to be used as this place of reflection, of telling oral stories, and hopefully with opportunities like this as well, that more and more of these stories will become known to the wider public.
So can you just tell me a little bit about, so the artwork has seven large-scale bullets?
Yeah, so the seven bullets are all symbolic and are metaphoric of human beings. Four are upstanding in their natural state as a bullet, so they're actually replicated off Australian bullets that are to scale 1 is to 100. So they end up about 7 to 8 meters tall, so very kind of commanding in scale, and three of the bullets are just the shells themselves, which are representative of the fallen men, and also a ceasefire is used as three shots fired into the air in war, so that's kind of got different meanings throughout the execution. There's all different things, descriptions going on, and the tentative title for it is Thou Didst Let Fall, and I chose that title. I thought it was quite poetic of, you know, representing the fallen soldiers, the men who survived, but on return to this country were left to fall again. And I think that's the overall respect of it all, is that, you know, when servicemen and women returned to this country, they were given land as settlement, and Aboriginal people were not given that land. They were, in fact, still getting their land taken off them. So the aftermath of, you know, war is something that I think needs to be recognised, and that I felt really needed to come through in the memorial as well, that this is an ongoing kind of issue. So yeah, the bullets themselves are replicative of that story, but of the fallen soldiers, and the materials they're made out of, the fallen shells are Cortens, which kind of has this earthly look to it, and it kind of bleeds, the material bleeds in itself, so around the ground of where the fallen bullets are, the landscape will actually change colour, and it's like they're almost kind of, going back into the ground.
Yep.
And the site itself, surrounded by the massive fig trees, it's a hope that the bullets will almost take on this organic kind of feeling as well, like they're growing out of the earth.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a bit more in detail about it.
Thanks. And just back to, you just mentioned earlier you'd worked as a war artist. Just wondering if you could just tell me a little bit more about that experience. So you were one of the, I think I read you were the first artist to be consigned to be a war artist in Australia since World War II. Is that correct?
I think that it is something around that. The idea of a traditional war artist is someone who is associated with the army, either as a soldier or with technical skills as an artist. So they're on hand, they're painting what they see. And recently the War Memorial has invited conceptually based artists to respond to the idea of war. So the other art like Ben Quilty and Sean Gladwell, Exter Medici, I think was in Timor. But yes, I was the first person to be based in Australia, and that's purely because Norforce does no overseas travel. It's based in Australia. It's border security. It's sea patrol. But what a lot of people don't realise is that it's built up of, I think, nearly 60 to 70% of just Aboriginal servicemen and women. So these are people who live in very regional and remote communities and are actually witnessing things, you know, like light aircraft flying over during the night. And so Norforce becomes the forefront of border protection within this country. So then they're non-confrontational or combat. Their idea is to survey, to get as much information as they can, send it through to intelligence to then infiltrate the area and find out what is going on. So I was fortunate enough to, I spent 2 weeks in a training camp with them, learning skills that they would learn on hand about how to assess campsites that they've stumbled across, how to identify different kind of clues and stuff about where these people might be from or what they are doing here, and assess whether it is something that needs to be called in for further investigation. Yeah.
Right. And how did you find that experience going up there?
It was incredible. To be honest, it took a lot of convincing. I already had certain, you know, my own views and perspectives about the way our country, I think, treats asylum seekers or refugees, and I kind of had no desire to go and spend 2 weeks out in the middle of nowhere, you know, as someone who grew up in the city, and I wouldn't say I was a great camper, but I actually loved it. It completely changed my perspective and point of view, and there was so much, I think, I didn't know or I didn't understand, which I felt I was very quick to judge on without understanding the realities of it. And, you know, a lot of the things that are taken out of this country includes cultural artifacts that belong to our own people. And it only makes sense that, you know, our own people are involved in the protection of that. And also I just feel it would be great for the wider majority of Australia to understand that our people are at the forefront of this, and you know that should be something that people know, and we hold our military or our servicemen with great regard in this country. And I think, you know, a great step forward would be the acknowledgement of Aboriginal people being part of that. I think it would be, you know, something that you know, is very important for people to realize that you know, the important roles that Aboriginal men and women had in the military as well.
You touched on it a little bit before, but can you just maybe expand and just tell me what really inspired you to be an artist?
Okay. It was a general love of art at first, but to be honest, and sometimes I always say it sounds a bit cliche, artists like Tracy Moffat and Gordon Bennett, who, you know, I always say they gave me this gift in this way of this realization that art doesn't have to be about a beautiful picture. It's actually, art can say something. Art can, you know, just do, you know, change the way people think, change the way we feel, change the world. And that was something that I became so much more interested in when I saw their work, that I could look at an issue or you know, something that was happening and transcribe it through art as a way of saying something. And that was the appeal of art to me, that, you know, I had these skills of, you know, being able to draw and paint, but it was the message which was you know, really, really important to me. And, you know, that's, you know, what conceptual art does. And that's, you know, where I was becoming so more politically and socially aware of the climate within Australia. And, you know, I felt like, you know, maybe I had this chance to be this vessel of getting these messages across through art rather than through other fields. So I think that was the main inspiration at first behind, you know, wanting to be an artist. Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about the process of your art? So sort of, I guess, you know, where do you start? Where do you get your ideas from? And how do you develop those ideas into an artwork?
Well, I feel my art is so much about a language of living here and now. So whilst we have a traditional practice, which, you know, I'm very well aware of and embrace and share with my family. We've done basket making, shield workshops, and all those things. You know, my life is built up on who I am and where I am. And my art, I think, reflects that. So it has a lot to do with the way I work in my practice. Is I decide something strikes me or something that I want to respond to, and then I pick the best way of executing it. So that's why I think my practice goes through, you know, from drawing to painting to video to photography to collage to sculptures. When I know what I want to say, I pick the best medium to do it in. And work with the best people on trying to execute that. That's very important for me, to try to get that message across the best way possible. So the foundation of my work usually comes from the idea first, but I could sit on that for a year, 2 years, researching, gathering all the information I can. At the end of the day, it might be just a text on a piece of paper, but that I feel after all that time physically can do the best portrayal of what I'm trying to say. Other times it can be a very labor intensive painting or you know, photographic suite of work where I get many technicians and people on hand because of the quality of output I feel needs to be very high, or, you know, it could be a snapshot with a disposable camera. You know, that it's the research and the content, you know, always outweighs for me the finished product. But, you know, in saying that, you know, you grow over the years as an artist, and I feel the best works are a mix of both. When you have a strong visual outlay to it and something responsive in a visual content, and then the backing theory component to it. So, you know, I always say I'm learning all the time, and I always think or believe your next work is going to be your best, because you're taking on everything you've learned from that point to make things better, you know, better and better. But that's kind of how I work as an artist, yeah.
And you've had a couple of shows. So there was one at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the show at the Art Gallery of New South Wales was an opportunity that happened while I was down in Sydney for Art Space, and one of the reasons I decided to stay in Sydney, that the gallery gave me this opportunity in its project space, which was something really amazing, because what tends to happen in Australian institutions is they have dedicated Aboriginal spaces, and that doesn't so much offend me. I think there should be dedicated Aboriginal spaces, but what you find is that they're delegated to the very back ends of the gallery. In art circles, we call them Darkies Corner. You know, you go right to the back of the gallery and then you find, oh, it's an Aboriginal space. And the Art Gallery of New South Wales was no exception to that. The Yirrabana section is literally in the basement of the gallery. And when I was given this opportunity that was not about being an Aboriginal artist, it was about being a contemporary artist and showing in a contemporary space in the gallery, I was very excited about that opportunity. And I was working on a trilogy of works. The previous two had been executed and shown, and the third one, you know, I was about to start working on. It was called Projected Future. And I felt that an institutional space was actually going to be one of the most important spaces to actually show it in. And being the third and final in the trilogy, I used things that weren't in the previous two. So there was an aspect of my own painting, my own photographs, but also mirrors attached to it. So it was very important that in this last work, the viewer became part of the artwork itself. And the work itself is also about 12 meters long, so it did need a very big space. So, you know, the end result of having it shown in an art institution, in a contemporary space, you know, was something that was very important. You know, for me, it was very important. And, you know, so I thought of that as, you know, a really wonderful opportunity and a chance for me also to be, you know, kind of this new boy in town, this new guy in Sydney to show people my work as well. So I also really liked that it was in Sydney as well, opposed to being back home in Brisbane or somewhere else.
Yeah. So your exhibition wasn't in Yerribana, it was in another...
No, yeah, it was in another space which they give over to artists without any curatorial intervention. And you get, there's might be three or four a year that can use that space. And I'm unsure if any other Aboriginal artists have ever got it. And I made a point of saying that when I opened the exhibition. And a lot of people came up to me afterwards and said, well, we've never really even thought about that. That why, there's a lot of times people go, oh, well, Aboriginal people have their space. They've got that. So why, you know, why should they be in this space as well? But that realization that no, we should be open to all spaces within in the gallery. Yeah, was something, you know, that I'm a very keen advocate for, and the peers, the people that I kind of hang around with as well, you know, very strongly believe that, you know, our art should sit with and alongside all other art practices, not just be categorised as just being Aboriginal. Yeah.
So in that exhibition, you used a lot of material that we'd call, you know, kitsch Aboriginal mm-hmm. objects. I think you call them Aboriginalia.
Yes,
is that what
yeah.
the term you've coined for them? Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about why you use those objects and how you use them?
Sure. Well, yeah, Aboriginalia, it's not a word, but I just feel it makes sense. And I've actually been collecting since I was a child. I grew up in a very modest working class family, and you know, that we bought things from second hand shops. That was the reality of the situation, and we actually loved it as children. There were, like, you know, treasure chests, and we always could, you know, were able to get things. And I came across this ephemera, and it just struck me. It started off with a love for the iconography itself, and as I grew older, started to understand a lot more of the sinister or political undertones attached to these kind of objects, or what it means to put an Aboriginal face on a plate or on an ashtray, or velvet paintings. But it started, you know, from a very naive perspective, and it was never intention that it would become part of my work at that point of collection. I didn't even know, you know, kind of what art was. But I had this abundant collection of this stuff, and it just by chance ended up being stored at my studio in Brisbane. And because I was working and looking at it so frequently, some of the motifs started to make their way into my work. To a point where I started to actually use the objects themselves. And that opened up a whole new kind of body of or way of thinking, and a whole way of transforming these objects into something completely new. So it did become a big part of my practice, you know, for nearly a decade. And that's as simple of where it come from, but, you know, you can read into the depth of that kind of iconography forever. You know, it's something that probably should be written about more, and you know, I certainly believe should be collected institutionally, these objects. And whilst, you know, we try to forget them now, and they became kind of invaluable relics of the past, it is how a whole generation of people grew up understanding Aboriginal culture through these objects. And undeniably, they were made to sell Australia to the world. You know, so in that way, you know, I think of them as incredibly important social artefacts. And yes, that became a big part of my practice, that our projected future was like the culmination of all that work for me. So I'm kind of looking at new avenues now and going back to painting or other modes that I was doing prior to the Aboriginalia. So it hasn't stopped, and I don't think I'll ever stop collecting, but it's certainly, I'm certainly looking at new things now. Yeah.
And can you? You were also recently exhibited at the Museum of Contemporary Art in an exhibition called String Theory. Can you tell me a little bit about the works that were in that exhibition?
Sure. Well, String Theory was a really an amazing show to be a part of, because the work I had in that was actually done in 2008 and had never been shown since then. So there was like a 5-year period. No one really responded or took to that work, yet it was, for me, one of my favorite works that I've ever done. And while I love the fact, that it was put into String Theory, was that it was a very personal work about my family from home. My cousin was having a bit of a hard time, and I said, just come down to Brisbane and let's make some work together. It was purely nothing more than the way in which we interact as people and help each other and support each other. And when I look and go and see my family in North Queensland, I see a lot of the battles they face with just being so isolated, and particularly for the young kids, you know, and not a lot to do. It kind of, you know, you get up to mischief and you can get caught in a bit of trouble. And I said, you know, come down and have a look at what I do, you know, because I really don't try to restrict myself in anything because of who I am as an Aboriginal person. In fact, I use that as a tool to defy those kind of notions, because one of the worst things I think can happen is we start to believe what people say about us. And, you know, that work... So we're in a 3K radius of the house. We went and took these photos using a Jawan, which is a rainforest bag. And through the outcome of the workshops we were doing was I was actually using my Jawan in day-to-day life, and felt that why these baskets were now being collected in the art world, they were still very functional objects that we had always used. So not to forget or maintain that culture, the cultural objects themselves. So yeah, we just made up with this idea that we'll go and to different locations and fill our jar. If we're going to the football, what we would take if we're going to work, you know, pack your lunch and or go grocery shopping with our jar. And they're like portraits, but the viewer is facing the sitter is facing away from the viewer, so they're invisible portraits in a way. You just see the back of the head, but you see the functionality of the Jawan, that it's actually worn on the head. So yeah, I was really surprised, but you know, very grateful that it was included in a show like String Theory, and a show about fiber that has photography in it. So I love the curator Glenn Barclay's talk, where he said, you know, a basket can be a photograph, you know, a weaving can be a painting. It kind of, again, overlooks those categories which institutions choose to pigeonhole you in. So that was, you know, something, you know, a show that I think was incredibly important, and was really, you know, really proud to be a part of.
You also, you worked at the Queensland Gallery of Modern Art.
Yes.
Is that correct? Yeah. So what did you, can you tell me about what your position was there and what
sure.
What you worked on there?
Well, I was 2 years into university, and a traineeship came up at the gallery for the show called Story Place, which was Indigenous art of Cape York and the rainforest. So for me, as you know, a 20-year-old university student, a massive show coming off North Queensland art, where my family was from, I was like, wow, this is amazing. Of course, I want to apply for this traineeship. And, you know, me as, you know, a black fella, a traineeship meant you got a year's work and then that was it. You kind of go back to what you were doing. Little did I know, 8 years later, I would still be working at the institution. So I went on there, you know, went through the traineeship in arts administration or something, and I did get a love for the institutional way of working, and I think that's really helped me in my art journey as well, knowing that kind of behind the scenes way of thinking, and that sometimes choices or things people are saying to you might be coming up from 10 other people as filters down. So, you know, there's big bureaucratic institutions that you deal with. But I was an exhibitions project officer and Indigenous training coordinator, I think one of the longest names, job titles ever. But it did mean that throughout my time, I then got another 10 Aboriginal trainees through the gallery. Wow. And I think maybe 8 of them ended up with full-time jobs out of that. The traineeship experience was not about training someone for the opportunity to get that qualification. It was training someone to get a job within the institution, and also within all areas of the institution, from conservation to administration through curatorship to design, that Aboriginal people are necessary in all fields, not just sitting within Aboriginal art. And that was really my experience, because I went into exhibition design and I loved that. I loved event programming and stuff like that. My primary interest within the institution wasn't just Aboriginal art, but it very much was also about how do we make institutions accessible to Aboriginal people. I went into the institution as an adult. I'd never been to the Queensland Art Gallery before, and like a lot of our people, didn't even know these places existed. And you go there and you kind of go, how do you even get in? Where's the front door? Do you have to pay? Do you have to dress a certain way to go in? These are how foreign these spaces are. So yet I always tell all the guests that come in, and especially Aboriginal people, this is your art. This belongs to you. That's one, you know, what these institutions are for. So that was a great love of mine for many, many years. And you know, my practice was escalating at the same time, and I think it got to a point where I had to decide, do I want to be an arts academic or do I want to actually be an artist in my own right? And you know, I came to that decision by thinking, what would I, you know, regret the most? And I thought, if I didn't give my own practice a go, that would be the one thing that I would always think, oh, I wish I would have done that. I made the decision and move to go into just making my own work.
You made the right decision.
I hope so. It's still, you know, there's a, I think, you know, art really is one of the hardest occupations ever. There's a facade or what people see and believe is very different to the reality. I've got great people, you know, supporting me, and you know, I belong to the Proper Now Collective, and just try to keep a really good positive outlook on things. But I always believe I'm very lucky to be in the position I'm in, and to be, you know, able to sustain myself just as an artist too. I know a lot of people do have to work or do something to subsidize their income or living, but for the moment, I'm able just to do my own work, so that's fantastic. Right. Yeah.
So you just mentioned your work with the Proper Now Collective. Can you tell me a little bit about what Proper Now Collective is about and your work with them?
Sure. Well, it's evolved a little bit over the years. It's nearly, like, it's over 10 years now we've been together, but Proper Now started off as a Brisbane-based artist collective, and at that time it was just about supporting each other. It was very, very difficult art scene in Brisbane. At the time, we're getting literally no opportunities institutionally. Our work was very much looked at the other. And the only way we're going to do things is if, one, we did them together, and two, we supported each other. Because that was the biggest thing, just having people come and say, that work is great. You know, we weren't hearing that kind of things. People were actually shunning and shying away from what we're doing because there was a harsh political reality to what we're saying that people did not want to hear. You know, this great saying that ignorance is bliss. It's much easier to not even, you know, go there with some things than to live with the reality of the situation. So we're putting on our own shows and just supporting each other. And through the different demographic, we had, you know, male, female, senior artist, emerging artist, and that was both in ages as well. You know, we had emerging senior people and then more known younger artists, but That strength we had, particularly through artists like Richard Bell, Vernon Aki, Gordon Hookey, who had already had such a high profile, they could really fight for us more emerging and younger artists and say, well, I won't be in this show unless you put these guys in and stuff like that. It gave us a bigger bargaining chip, which I was really surprised, you know, one, we had to do, but what these artists were doing for a long time. Like, you know, Richard used to go and see curators and just demand to be in shows. They really paved the way. It did make us easier, did make things easier for us now, but those preconceived ideas still existed, and it was very, 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 very tough. And I mean, even now people look at us and say, oh, you have so much great opportunities and things like that, but it's, you know, the reality is, like, you know, if we were white, we'd be in a very, very different position to where we are right now. And, you know, I still feel it's, you know, a constant daily struggle. So that's kind of what Proper Now became of it. Now I think we're a little more quiet, maybe. We live in different areas now. Come down in Sydney, Megan's in Melbourne. And, you know, just taking more time to do things, I think, than what we did when we were all together.
Yeah.
And we're a consensus-based group too, which means that everyone has to agree on something before we do it. It's not a majority rules kind of thing. So things take an incredibly long time. But, you know, that's kind of, you know, this great thing. We wait, and then when everyone's happy, we do something. So that's been, you know, a really interesting process for me to kind of go through and understand, particularly with my institutional background. I know, you know, sometimes things need to be done in an hour, and what we have a way of working that is just not conducive to mainstream way of thinking, and we've just accepted that, and that if you work with us, then you go on this ride with us and learn and understand different ways of thinking and working, and that's definitely not a bad thing. Yeah.
You also worked as Richard Bell's assistant for a few years, I believe. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience
and
what you learned from Richard?
You know, Richard has been one of the greatest inspirators and mentors in my life. I think I usually say for a nearly 5-year period, we didn't have breakfast, lunch or dinner without each other. Like, that's how, you know, we're sharing the studio. I was, you know, working for him, painting for him. And Richard is like this artist who just talks all the time. So when he's working, he's constantly telling you things. And I just feel I learned so much from someone who didn't read about these experiences. He lived these experiences. What he was telling you about things was because he was there. And that was really incredible. He, you know, we had a very open door policy to the studio as well, so we always had visitors and always people traveling that would know Richard would come in. And I, you know, got to just meet so many incredible, incredibly amazing people, and, you know, some of my heroes, and you know, and that I think is a little bit of like the ethic behind Proper Now as well. And I very much found it something that we did in Brisbane, was that, you know, you met someone and you asked how they were and then what you could do for them. And that was an important, you know, ethic behind the way we work, is that we share with each other. We kind of don't hide things away from people. And through sharing, you get the best outcome in your work as well. So that was another, you know, I think it was something we have as people anyway, but you know, Richard and Proper Now just really reinforce that idea that, you know, we are all here to help each other, and the best outcome we can ever get is through doing that. And of course, with Richard, there's a lot of fun along the way. A lot of going out in the evenings and a lot of partying, and it's really great.
And just finally, can you tell me, where to next in your career? What would you like to achieve over the next few years?
Well, to get these bigger projects out of the way would be amazing, but to do it and give them so much justice. Like, the memorial for me is quite possibly going to be the biggest thing I'll ever get the opportunity to do, without a doubt. And, you know, it's only going to be successful if it is collaborative with the community and that its longevity is that it is used. It does become a place for congregation. It does become a place for reflection and that the community uses, or else it's just, you know, a failure. Other than that, so I really want to, you know, pour my heart and soul into that and make sure that it gives justice to, you know, the most significant story that, you know, this country, you know, has denied, you know, to bring historical truth, you know, back into, you know, the education system. But from there, I'd love to, you know, coming now being based in Sydney, there's this realization, Sydney I kind of feel is a platform for the rest of the world. And I'd like to follow in the footsteps of other artists and spend some time outside of Australia too, on longer periods of time. In the privileges I've had of doing short trips overseas, you realize you get this better opportunity to reflect or understand from looking from the outside in, whereas on the inside, it's very easy to be blinded by things or not understand things. So I'm really interested in living and working in some other places. And yeah, that's maybe I can see a little bit of the projected future is, yeah, tying up some of the great projects I have here and then maybe doing something overseas, but not for too long. Always come back here. Or yeah.
Excellent. Thanks, Tony. Is there anything else you'd like to add, or think you've said a lot?
I can talk underwater, yeah.
That's good. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.